This is supposed to be a session from now till coffee break on which is titled Liability and Responsibility, the Strange Repudiation of Common Sense. I worked a long time at that title, and basically it's a first half described something I want to get you thinking about this morning, and the second half was a recognition that nobody would come to a discussion titled Liability and Responsibility, so I better put something more provocative in there. I don't know, maybe I'm wasting my time saying this, even because people don't come to continued series anyway around here, and that's just as well, but this is a link. This morning's session is a link between what I was doing on Monday and what I want to do on Friday. Friday's session is called The Pursuit of Equality. And what undergirds all of these sessions that I'm doing this week is one question that has increasingly obsessed me in my own life, my personal life of activity, and in my life of scientific inquiry. I'm an economist, and the question that keeps bothering me as an economist who studies social systems and as a human being living in a city is, how do we, in a large, complex, urban, industrialized, highly impersonal, necessarily highly impersonal environment, how do we come to care for one another? And I like that phrase, care for one another. Notice it has two meanings. I use it a lot. You see, I care for you. Could mean I like you, which means I know something about you. I'm fond of you. I'm drawn to you. I really care for her. I don't care for him. But it also has that other meaning of taking care of. And I think those two things are related. And it's a problem in our society. I think it's a growing problem for a variety of reasons. And, how do we care for one another? And it ain't easy. You know? We began thinking in the 1930s that we could do it rather simply. The old village life had broken down, the traditional institutions weren't working anymore, but that was good. We were moving into a new, more rapid, we're moving to the modern world. And what we would do, government would take over the place that had previously been occupied by churches and private philanthropic associations and neighbors and extended families. Who used to take care of the old folks? Well, the kids, because the old folks lived right around them. But as that society breaks up, through mobility, which is related to affluence, and the parents live in one part of the country and the children live in another part and the grandchildren yet somewhere else, then we devise social security, where the state, the government, takes over. All very fine, but it's developed some very serious problems. And I'm not just thinking of the underfinancing of social security. I'm thinking of really the question, is it possible for the government to take the place of the older institutions? Is it really possible for us to care for one another through the government? I'm quite convinced it is not possible for us to care for one another adequately through the economic system, through the marketplace. Although the marketplace does very important work and contributes a sizable chunk of the foundation, it makes a lot of things possible. Nonetheless, the marketplace, people fall through the crevices. There's a lot of uncared for folk out there, and I see no way that the market can care for them. I also happen to see no way that the government can care for them. And the question that obsesses me is, what's left? Well, enough of that long introductory speech. I hope you find what I'm saying this morning somewhat unorganized. Because I've got no thesis, I want to call your attention to it. I deliberately went through, this was better organized in the first draft. And then I went through again and took the organization out so that you wouldn't think I was arguing a thesis, because I am arguing a thesis. But I don't want you to concentrate on it. I want you to just reflect on some of the things that I want to call to your attention. But to begin with, I want to tell you about a little model that I use, and this hooks up with last time very clearly. On Monday we were talking a lot about discrimination, and let me tell you how I view the world with respect to discrimination. First of all, I say many goods are scarce. Many goods are scarce. Most goods are scarce. Most things are good or scarce. By scarce, I mean simply that everyone cannot have all they would want at zero cost to them. Now, you can have all the Rolls Royces you want. Did you know that? You can have all the Rolls Royces you want as long as you are willing to pay the appropriate cost. But but the cost is not zero, therefore Rolls Royces are scarce. Now, most goods are scarce in that sense. Lobster is scarce. The presidency of the United States is a scarce good. This chair at this hour is a scarce good. Some of you out there wish you had it so that you could get this all straight. Ice cream cones in the snack bar after Vespers are scarce goods. Those are all scarce. Now, when goods are scarce, Proposition 2, rationing must occur. In some fashion, we've got to allocate them out. And we do that by discriminatory criteria. We say, all right, you get it and you don't, or you get it now, you get it later. And in some fashion, we set up discriminatory criteria, or they evolve. In any event, they will exist. If goods are scarce, they will be rationed. There's no choice. Now, they will be rationed by some discriminatory criteria. Those criteria may be stupid. They may be wise. They may have unfortunate consequences. I'm not saying anything about that, but there will be some discriminatory criteria. Go back through the things I mentioned before. Lobster is rationed by the criterion of willingness and ability to pay money. Proximity to Maine helps a little bit, but not much. Because lobster travel easily, see? Presidency of the United States, what are the discriminatory criteria by which that goodie is allocated? I'm not sure. I tried to jot down a whole bunch of them. I got good looks, intelligence. Well, it is. It plays in energy, other directedness, ruthlessness, doggedness, and arrogance. Those are some of the things. But a lot of people, we're not quite sure what the criteria are, and so a lot of people are searching for those criteria, trying to find out what they are. What are the criteria by means of which this chair at this hour is allocated? Well, that's even more vague. Walt Bowman knows something about that. If you think about ice cream, the last item, ice cream cones after Vespers, they're allocated not primarily, I think, by means of money, because the amount of money that you pay for an ice cream cone here, at least after Vespers, is not that significant, given the incomes of most of the people who come up here. It's willingness to stand in line. But it's something more than willingness to stand in line. There's also something, willingness to sit close to the door in Vespers. or willingness to push and run to get out quickly. You know, and people have these things too, and hence speed. Someone who walks with a cane is at a distinct disadvantage. But then there's also a simple willingness to cut the line. The third point, and then we'll get on. This is just the model. This is how I look at the world. You'll see, I hope, how it links up. That when the criteria by which goods are rationed are clear and known, then people will act in ways designed to satisfy them. They will act, not everybody, but those people who want that good. Thus, if goods are allocated heavily on the basis of willingness and ability to pay money, people will act in ways designed to secure for themselves sizable quantities of money. If goods are allocated on the basis of obvious virtue, and see, some goods are, aren't they? For example, in a family, frequently, you say, yes, Junior, you can do it because you have been good. What will Junior do? Don't say Junior will be good. Junior will appear good. There's a difference. Very important difference. The criteria are not always clear and known, and I would just point out in leaving this subject that when the criteria by means of which scarce goods are allocated are not clear and known, the dispenser of those goods acquires a good deal of power. Thus, A grades are frequently allocated by vague criteria, and that puts power in the hands of college professors who, parents have power because they, in fact, kids often like to ask for the rules. What are the criteria by means of which these goodies will be allocated? It may take the form of, well, what time am I through with the housework so I can go out and play? And the parent wants to retain more power and says, I'll let you know as we proceed. All right. Now, I think it's very clear that some discriminatory criteria are better than others. I don't think there are any criteria that are wholly satisfactory in all situations, but I want you to think about two, that one of which enjoys much too fine a reputation. It doesn't deserve it. And the other, I think, maybe it doesn't deserve it. It ought to have a better reputation. The one that deserves much too good a reputation is need. A lot of people think that, you see how this links up now with how do we care for one another? How do we allocate goods? Wouldn't it be good if we just allocated goods on the basis of need? Well, that would be the discriminatory criterion. If you don't need it, you wouldn't get it. If you do need it, you get it. That's lovely. The only trouble is it's lovely until you think about it. But in our society, whatever might be the case in some other society somewhere in the world or in history, needs cannot be adequately specified. Basic needs are food, shelter, clothing, medical care. Well, if you think concretely, if you don't allow yourself to stay up in the cuckoo land of vague abstractions here, even food, clothing, shelter, and medical care are not physiologically determined necessities. Sure, we all need food, but we all want and insist upon and will have considerably more than we would need simply to sustain biological life. Or medical care is a good example. We will never be able to provide people with all the medical care they need, because what they think they need is what they think society is able to provide. So once kidney dialysis machines are invented, everyone with kidney problems needs them. And our needs are always going to be ahead of the ability to supply them, simply because as soon as a new medical care facility becomes available, it's not likely to be available in a quantity sufficient to satisfy everybody who might have some use for it, but people will want it, and they will say they need it in order to sustain life. I said some criteria. I would really urge you, if you think that the good society is one in which goodies are distributed according to need, I'd urge you to think again. It doesn't really say anything. That's like saying, well, I have been in discussions, sometimes even up here at Holden Village, where we're trying to work out what would be a solution to a social problem. Someone says, the solution is simple, and I don't know why we haven't recognized it. All we have to do is love one another. That's not a simple solution. I mean, quite aside from the question of how we come to love one another, it isn't clear even what love requires. Sure, it'd be a lot better world if we all loved one another more. But it is very difficult to effectively love, I split that infinitive, to love effectively people whom we don't know very well. And a good bit of harm is done by what we think are loving acts, but which acts which are not appropriate. And that's more likely to be true as we are interacting with people whom we know less well. All right. Now, I want to turn to a criterion for discriminating. That's a bad word, isn't it, discriminating? Which everyone agrees is discriminatory, in the bad sense. We sometimes distribute scarce goods to individuals on the basis of their membership or non-membership in groups which tend to possess characteristics that may or may not be possessed by that particular individual. Let me give you an example. Are you aware of the fact that, on average, the income of blacks in the United States is lower than the income of whites? Okay, all right, everybody knows that, all right? Would you agree that the higher a person's income, other things being equal, the more credit-worthy he is. I hope you do. If you don't agree with that, you'll never get a job at a bank. I said other things being equal. All right, now banks would like to loan only to credit-worthy people, people who will repay. And so what they do is they look for evidence from your past life that you're going to repay. Now, they don't have perfect information. They never know everything about you, so they pick up certain signals. Like, if you've lived in the same house for 7 years, that says something about you. That says you're stable, you tend to meet your obligations. So they're more likely to loan you money than if you only lived there 1 year. There are people who have been turned down for loans because they haven't lived at their present residence for at least 2 years. Now, does that mean that people who don't live someplace 2 years are Welshers? Not at all. What the bank is doing is, on the basis of limited information, it's using certain signals. It can tell that you haven't lived there 2 years, and it's looking for a weight of evidence from the other side to overcome that. Now, notice what I said about blacks. Why do blacks get discriminated against at banks, or why have they in the past? Because there's some question, some people argue that they're not being discriminated against anymore. One reason is because bank officers, lending officers, were using skin color as an indicator of creditworthiness in a situation where they didn't have complete knowledge. I think that if bank officers had known that a particular black person was creditworthy, they would have been just as eager to extend the money, because after all, if you're a white person who is hostile to blacks, lending them money doesn't require you to, you know, enter into intimate relationships with them. The lending of money is a kind of social activity where you can keep all sorts of social distance if you want to. It doesn't seem rational to me for banks to discriminate against people solely on the basis of race, but it would be, quote, rational for banks to deny credit more frequently to blacks than to whites who were otherwise similarly situated in a situation where they didn't have adequate knowledge. Now, what's the point I'm making out of all this? I don't approve of this. I cite this as an example of where, in fact, in our society, we've discriminated against people on the basis of their membership in a group on the assumption that those individuals possess the characteristics possessed by that group, where we were couldn't be sure whether they did or not. Now, I think that example I gave is a bad one. I think we would all be willing to condemn it. We would say banks must just drop that. Sure, skin color is an indication of income, one indication, but it's a rotten one. There are better ones. Banks ought to go to a little more trouble and acquire better information. Stop using that. Well, I think we would all agree. Now, let me try another one. Insurance companies.
Professor Haney, black bank in Seattle, every bank uses those same criteria against their own blacks.
Yeah, I know they do. There's a bank in Seattle that was founded by a group of black professional people and businessmen called the Liberty Bank, and got an enormous amount of assistance from Seattle First National. And it was going to give credit on, it was going to end all this discrimination. And I was talking to a pastor of a large Baptist church in Seattle who had been in on the subscription because he wanted, banks, a bank finally that would be, as he put it, oriented to people. And he has withdrawn from the board of the bank because he found that what that bank was doing was using creditworthiness as a criteria for making loans. And the bank started using creditworthiness because the bank was about to fail. There's a women's bank in New York City that has run into a very similar problem. The first all-women's bank. All the officers were women, and they were going, I forget the name of it, probably called the Women's Bank. But they have been really on the rocks, very, very close to teetering. They were getting aid from other banks in order to stay alive. But what they were doing was they were using being a woman as a positive criterion. But if being a woman is not an indication that you're uncreditworthy, it probably isn't a very good indication that you're creditworthy either. So they were loaning too much money to women who weren't paying it back. I want to rush on to, get to the point, to the case of discrimination against unmarried males under the age of 25 by insurance companies. I would like you to think about this. This is being agitated currently. When an insurance company tells a 22-year-old unmarried male that he has got to pay premiums that are double what you would have to pay in order to get automobile insurance, that's discrimination. But why is it doing it? The insurance company is using age, sex, and marital status as a dummy for, it was a substitute, as a proxy for recklessness. And statistically, you can show there is a correlation. Other things being equal, somebody under 25, unmarried, and male is much more likely to have an accident than people who don't possess one or two or all three of those characteristics. Now, suppose we have here a super cautious, careful, excellent driver, unmarried, 22-year-old male. It's unfair, isn't it? And somebody has taken it to court. It's in the courts right now. I hope he loses. I think that's a form of discrimination against an individual on the basis of his being a member of a group that is socially desirable. I wish it weren't, but see, the problem is, what the insurance company would really like to do is charge high premiums to reckless drivers and low premiums to good drivers, but it can't find them. And so it uses substitute indicators in the presence of scarce information. Well, now let me raise one that's really gotten to be important. How about, and here's one, I'm against the first one, for the second one, and on this one, I don't know what I think. I think it's really tough, but it's being agitated. How about discrimination in selling pensions or life insurance on the basis of life expectancies derived from actuarial tables related to sex? You know, if you sell life insurance or pensions, it comes to the same thing, and you don't charge the women more, women get a better deal. Or you need to charge them more or reduce their benefits, because women tend to live longer than men. But now, what's discrimination? What is charging them all the same discrimination against men, or is charging the women more discrimination against women? I don't know. I'd say both. I mean, charging the women more is discrimination against women. Charging them all the same is discrimination against men. But the real question is not, do we want to discriminate? We've got to discriminate. Discrimination is the essence of life. We like discriminating people, don't we? The question is, are those socially tolerable discriminatory criteria? And I don't know. How about discrimination, again, with life insurance and premiums, and pension premiums, between smokers and non-smokers? Well, most people say, oh, it's okay to charge smokers more, because smokers bring it on themselves. You know, a lot of people would say, it's no fair. And this is an argument. We just shouldn't divide the population up into men and women. You know, if you put all the men and all the women together, then their life the average life expectancy is the same for men and women. Obviously, it all depends. It all depends on what pool you create. You know. So the question is, how many pools are you allowed to create? The ideal pool, you see, would be every individual's in his own pool. But then we would have to have. But then we couldn't use actuarial tables. We would have to have information about each individual. But if we had adequate information about each individual, there'd be no point in insurance. So we're in a trap. The demand for insurance and pensions and this stuff arises from ignorance. And ignorance requires us to do things that we wish we didn't have to do, but what we have to do. We have to make judgments about people on the basis of their membership in a group. And of course, the person who says, but I'm better than my group, like a kid who says, I'm a safer driver than most kids, you say, tough, buddy. A woman who, now suppose we charge women more for pensions, or we make their benefits lower. A woman says, but I have got terminal disease. I'm going to die at the age of 45. Tough, you're a woman. Why not put her in the category of those who are likely to die at the age of 45? Well, smokers and non-smokers, people say, well, that's okay, we can divide those up, because smokers are wicked people anyway, and they bring it on themselves. Well, okay, but what about diabetics and non-diabetics? Insurance companies do distinguish. Diabetics don't bring it on themselves, but a diabetic has to pay more for life insurance. Or what about people with long-lived ancestors? Insurance companies do not discriminate there, but that's a good criterion on which to discriminate.
Some do.
They do now?
Yes, they are now asking you whether your how long your parents lived and grandparents, and if they are not alive, what was the cause of death, natural accident.
Well, do they adjust the? I've been told that they will tend to reject the policy and give some Mickey Mouse reason, some phony. Well, okay, but I'm not surprised. Because that's one of the best pieces of information. If you want to know how long you're going to live, look at the length of life of your ancestors. That's one of the best indications. But, is that fair? I mean, here you are. First of all, you've got to live with the probability that you will have a heart attack before 50 because your father and your grandfather did. And on top of that, you've got to pay more for your life insurance. The problem, as I said, is that if we had complete information about each person, we wouldn't have to treat people as members of groups. Then we wouldn't have insurance or pension systems. Now, conclusion. I would like you to write this on your shirt cuff. Information is scarce. You know that? I have sometimes told students that there is no more important truth for you to carry out of this course in economics, I teach a lot of introductory economics, than a vivid recognition of the fact that information is scarce, coupled, of course, with a recognition of the enormous number of policy proposals that are made in our society on the assumption that information is not scarce. Let me give you some examples of ways in which we deny in practice that information is scarce. And I hope you will see that in all of these cases, we are, as a society, or as individuals acting within society, we're struggling to care for people, or to establish institutions that do a better job of caring, keep people alive, and keep them healthy, and keep them from hurting themselves, and so on. But what I'm trying to point out in each instance is that we tend to misfire because we're forgetting that information is scarce. My first example is the growing tendency to hold physicians liable for any and every unfortunate outcome. Physicians talk about the malpractice crisis. But malpractice used to mean that the physician was not employing the best, the accepted medical technique. In other words, he had done something for which his professor in medical school would justifiably have given him a flunking grade. He did not do something that definitely should have been done, that a prudent, reasonable, well-informed, and responsible physician would have done. That's no longer the meaning of malpractice. People are suing physicians for malpractice because the physician did not know everything. They're suing him for not knowing something that he could not reasonably have been expected to know. Now, what's the consequence of this? Well, there are a number of consequences. One is higher malpractice premiums, which lead to higher fees for patients. Another one, which I worry somewhat more about, is excessive testing. If the physician is going to be liable for ignorance, the physician is going to be responsible for acquiring more information. And how can he acquire more information? By subjecting you to more tests. How many tests are enough? There's always one more test. One person out of a million, he knows from his books, tends to go into an epileptic fit if treated with tickling on the bottom of the feet. So he doesn't dare tickle you on the bottom of the feet until he subjects you to this test. Now, this is a very painful test, which requires, so the testing is not only expensive, it is also often painful, very uncomfortable to the patient, and time-consuming, and that's a cost. Are we ahead of the game? The fact of the scarcity of information doesn't imply that we ought to acquire more information. We ought to acquire additional information only up to the point where acquiring additional information costs us more than it's worth. But you see, if information is scarce, so we don't know what that point is, so we kind of grope blindly. It's not completely blindly. We grope largely on the basis of the knowledge of people who have good reason to have some knowledge. Thus, a physician knows that he is liable for malpractice. And he knows, in the olden days, he knew that malpractice meant not doing something which, you know, Professor Schlemiel back there at the medical school would be horrified to find out he hadn't done. If he doesn't do something because he's got to get out on the links, he knew that he could be hit with a malpractice suit. And so because he was being held liable, he, a knowledgeable person, see, a very knowledgeable person, behaved responsibly. But if we push liability too far, we create irresponsible behavior. People respond to that for which they are liable, but they're not being now responsible in a bigger sense of the word. What I mean is, they're not behaving in the way we wish they would behave. Let me give what I think is a very interesting example from another area. It's still medical care, but we have instructed the Food and Drug Administration to withhold approval from new drugs that drug companies want to market until the drugs have been adequately tested. Now, what we're concerned about, of course, is side effects, like thalidomide. The thalidomide disaster had a lot to do with our move toward increasing the power of the FDA and putting additional pressure on the FDA to be cautious in granting approval of drugs. And I have read statements. I just recently read a statement. If the Food and Drug Administration withholds approval of a drug for 3 years, and even if that does cost the drug company $1 million in lost profits, it's worth it if it saves just one life. Now, that way of putting it just neatly confuses the whole issue. The principal cost of valuable drugs withheld from the market is lives lost because that drug is not available. We have to balance two things. There is always a risk, you can't avoid it, that a new drug will have a side effect for someone that we didn't know about and that is disastrous. That's a risk. But as we try to reduce that risk, we increase the risk that people will suffer and die because drugs that would have bailed them out aren't available. Now, where is the proper point at which to stop? Well, you see, the proper point at which to stop is right in the middle there, you know, where the additional lives lost are equal to the additional lives saved. But what I want to point out is that our present system almost guarantees we won't reach that point. We'll go past it. Why? Because the FDA, the people on the FDA, receive no blame or credit when they approve drugs prematurely. When they wait too long. The FDA, suppose you're a commissioner, an FDA commissioner, and you block a drug and block a drug and block a drug, and during that time 1,700 people die whom that drug would have saved. No one will ever know it. No one will ever bring that to your doorstep. Because it's just not known, and you can't figure out who the lives were. Then. You have to make guesses about who they are. But if you approve the drug and one person dies, they will lay it on your doorstep. And so the FDA is overly safety conscious. It's not really safety. It's overly conservative. The FDA and many other agencies in government tend to drag their feet too long. They tend to pay too much attention to particular hazards because the system is structured in a way that gives them rewards for paying attention to hazards of one sort and does not give them rewards for paying attention to hazards of another sort. That is the hazards of not having the drug available. The system, careful and students who have no stock in drug companies have demonstrated repeatedly that the FDA is costing lives every year. Liability and responsibility. Now, one last example. We're moving, I think, toward the substitution of a rule caveat venditor for caveat emptor. Caveat emptor was the old Latin phrase for let the buyer beware. And what it meant in law was that unless the seller gave you an explicit warranty, this will remove the unsightly hairs, you had no guarantee. There was no such thing as an implicit warranty. I mean, so he gives you a bottle that says hair remover, and it doesn't say anything else on it, and you take it home, and you you put it on your legs, and that's males, your ball. It's hair restorer. Let's try that. All right. You put it on your head, and you can't see any evidence, and you go back, and you say, this didn't work. I want my money back. And he says, well, it just doesn't work for you. And, you feel gypped. Well, now that's probably a bit extreme, but if it didn't say on the bottle that anything that specifically guaranteed that it would grow hair on your head, you've got no kickback. It's let the buyer beware. You know, and then that would mean that the buyer could take his own precautions. See, it would mean, for example, you'd investigate, you'd ask for evidence on whose head has this grown hair, you know? Which, when you put the liability on the buyer behaves responsibly. He takes care of himself. Huh? Well, what we're doing now is moving very rapidly toward complete producer liability. And that has some very unfortunate consequences. For one thing, it encourages the buyer to act like a fool. There are all sorts of uses of the product which are critically related to the situation of the particular buyer. But what people do is they just rush in, they'll buy any old idiotic thing and take it home and find out it's not right, bring it back and demand their money back. They're wasting their time and it's costly to the producer. Because it doesn't matter, you know, how many people have used it? Well, it doesn't matter, I'll bring it back. But I'm not as concerned about that as I am about producer liability rules that are being written into statutes now, which make which compel manufacturers to produce foolproof products. Well, when you got to produce foolproof products, because even if a fool uses it and hurts himself, you can be sued. Those products are going to be very expensive. Maybe you have heard the story. I am fairly reliably informed that it's mythical. But it was repeated by the president of the American Bar Association, and you know what reliable people they are. But I don't. If it isn't true, it ought to be true, because there have been other cases a little more complicated to describe to get at the same thing. But he repeated the story that some guy was able to sue the manufacturer of a rotary lawnmower because he clipped off his fingers while using it, but he was using it to trim a hedge. that may not be a true story.
Our local newspaper said it came out of Tacoma, Washington. There were two guys who were on each side of the hedge and supposedly picked it up to try to trim the hedge.
Well, I wish I could run it down, because it is a neat story. Now, I do not think that producers of rotary lawnmowers ought to be liable for fingers cut off when people are behaving in foolish ways. It's true. Maybe the people won't stick their fingers in there just because they can sue if they. That's not the point. But what the point is that there are fools floating around, and if manufacturers have to guard against all forms of foolish behavior, they're going to make products extremely complicated, and they won't work very well then either. And they're going to use scarce non-renewable resources. On top of that, they'll be expensive. All right. Liability and responsibility are causally connected. Let me give you one more example of where I think we miss this. I hate motorcycles. My son owns one. My 16-year-old son owns one. But that doesn't mean I dislike. Well, I like to ride around. I hate the noise they make. I would not dislike motorcycles if everyone had ran a quiet motorcycle. I've seen three. but I hate. I think it is uncivilized. And uncivilizing for somebody to get on a motorcycle and race down the street. Now, so does the Environmental Protection Agency. They also believe that motorcycles make a lot of noise and it's bad for us and it corrupts the environment. We are agreed, for once, I agree with the EPA. But you know what they're doing? They are proposing new and tougher standards for mufflers. We have not begun to enforce the muffler laws we have. The additional benefit in terms of quiet from enforcing tougher muffler laws relative to the cost is minuscule. The additional benefit relative to the cost of making mufflers better, that's what I want to say, is minuscule. The additional benefit relative to the cost of requiring motorcycle owners to obey the rules we already got is huge. And I've wondered, why don't we do that? Why are we going after the manufacturers of motorcycles when we could get far more peace and quiet for the buck by going after the drivers of motorcycles? And I think the answer is we are operating under a myth that business creates all problems. And it's only fair to attack business. Business produces motorcycles, and that's what creates the noise. It wouldn't be fair to go after that sweet little 16-year-old driving motorcycle. In fact, we'll all admit, sure, it's true, people will take off mufflers or change them so they make a lot of noise. But that's not their fault. It's the fault of the manufacturer who allows them to do it. So what I think we're going to wind up with is mufflers that don't allow any noise to come out, and that are secured to the motorcycle with some kind of attachment that cuts your head off if you try to remove it. But see, you've got to secure the cooperation of an awful lot of people to solve any important social problem. And that means you've got to make them liable, at least in an impersonal society. Let me just ask you some questions. I'm getting close to the end here. I better hustle. How much liability for unfortunate life outcomes should the owners of those lives bear? New Zealand, a couple of years ago, enacted a law with sort of a universal accident compensation system. And I found out about it through reading a story about a safe cracker who blew off three fingers while trying to rob a safe. And he got accident compensation. Well, I think there's something to be said. There's something to be said. But it's kind of a universal no-fault insurance. You know? He went to jail, but he got compensation. Seriously, don't throw that out. I think there is something to be said. I think that some of the undesirable ways in which we're moving, we could check that if we would move towards some kind of universal compensation. I think the malpractice problem, for example, ought to be addressed in this way. What's happening is juries are handing down these huge verdicts for what they call malpractice, but what is not really malpractice, because the jury says, but gee, how would you like to have that happen to you? And what we're saying is we ought to compensate that poor person. Well, all right, if we as a society feel that we ought to compensate the victims of misfortune, let us as society compensate the victims of misfortune. Let's not set up this Rube Goldberg device that requires us first to prove a falsehood, that a physician was guilty of malpractice. Let's move directly toward compensating the individual. Now that raises some problems. What is a misfortune that ought to be compensated? What about the premature loss of hair? Well, you know, or what about, now take a seat, to move from the ridiculous to the profound, what about the death of a child? A couple in our age where we don't expect infant mortality rates to be high, that loses a child has suffered a severe misfortune. Should they be compensated? Should they be given money to compensate them, which is what we usually give to compensate people? But there are all kinds of things in between. You know, how many misfortunes? Which misfortunes? But I think we must above all be careful that we don't start compensating misfortunes where there is a significant moral hazard. The insurance companies talk about moral hazard. Moral hazard is a situation where the existence of insurance makes it more likely that the misfortune will occur. Where is there significant moral hazard? Well, how about home fire insurance? Is there a significant moral hazard there? There is a moral hazard. You say, well, how many people burn down their homes because they got fire insurance? That's not the point. How much more careful would people be if they couldn't get fire insurance on their houses? They'd be significantly more careful. Or think of your own automobile. What do you do with your automobile? You can get, most of you have, theft insurance for your automobile. Why is there so much automobile theft in this country? In part because people have automobile theft insurance. If you didn't have automobile theft insurance, you would always lock your car before leaving it, and you'd take some much greater precautions, and there would be far less theft. So there is a moral hazard problem with automobile insurance. What about heart disease? Is there a moral hazard problem there? Yes, I think there is. Nobody goes out and gets heart disease because he can get insurance, life insurance, but if people could not get life insurance and wanted to provide for their families, maybe they would keep their weight down. a little more effectively. Now, it's a matter of degree here. I don't think the moral hazard problem is too significant with life insurance, but insurance companies do recognize that they're very no double indemnity for suicide. And in cases where you contributed to the death of someone else and had them insured, you get no recovery. But there are lots of problems where the moral hazard is significant. And I would like you to think just about one misfortune. What about the misfortune of poverty? To what extent can we, in an impersonal society, insure people against the misfortune of poverty? Is there a significant moral hazard? I think you can see now where I'm drifting into the next Friday's topic, the pursuit of equality. To what extent, I'm just going to ask this question today. To what extent do individuals choose to be poor? So that if you insured them against being poor, against the consequences, in other words, you made them not liable for the consequences of their choices, they would take those choices more often. Well, nobody chooses to be poor, right? Let's think about it a little more carefully. We're all aware, I hope, if we're not, let me stress them, there are very serious constraints on one's ability to choose in this area. Nobody chooses from scratch. But people do some choosing. You can argue that their choices are conditioned. In other words, for example, here's somebody who chose to go to work at the age of 12 and to work 17 hours a day, 7 days a week, for 40 years because he wanted to be rich. And finally, he made it. And you could say, well, he chose to be rich. He chose to avoid poverty. Or someone else who chooses to lie on the beach all day long in sun and only eat what he can get in the form of handouts from passers-by. You can say he chose to be poor. But on the other hand, someone could argue, but that those choices were the basis of prior social conditioning. It was the way his parents brought him up. Well, I don't know how far you can go with that. I do know this, that if you assume that people have no choices, that all their behavior is conditioned, you are yourself adopting a form of conditioning. That's interesting. One of the things that conditions behavior in our society is the belief, erroneous though it might be, that people are responsible for their choices. And if a society which begins preaching that people are not responsible for their choices is going to begin conditioning people to behave in different ways. Anybody who has meddled in psychotherapy knows this, that you can tell a person you're not responsible and thereby encourage them not to be responsible. On the other hand, you can take a therapeutic line and says, hey, look, buddy, what's your problem? And he says, I got this. Well, dummy, if you're an alcoholic. Yes, I can't help it. What's your problem? Your problem is you drink too much. What am I going to do? Stop drinking, stupid. You know, that's a form of therapy. The guy says, I can't. What do you mean you can't? You can't do. All you do is put the glass down. You know, and what I'm saying is that anybody who's meddled in psychotherapy knows that this does have some effect. If you tell people you're not responsible, they'll say, oh, goody, I'm not responsible. And they'll lean more. All right. The question is here, where are the choices? To what extent are people, I'm asking now, to what extent are people choosing to be poor? Consider two-earner families. The average family income in the United States is very much dependent upon the number of cases in which both husband and wife work. Isn't that a choice? Or consumption versus investment decisions. If you decide to take all your income and consume it, you will tend after a few years to be poorer than someone who chose to take a lot of their income and invest it. Isn't that a choice? And notice the number of investment decisions you make. It's not just that you take your money income and put it in the stock market or blow it on going out to dinner. That's an investment consumption decision. But people who choose to buy a house and fix it up are making investment decisions relative to people who choose to rent and say, oh, I don't want all those responsibilities. Home owning is a very important part of investment, and homeowners are much more likely to be investors rather than consumers. People who are oriented towards sticking a chunk of their income away, and they will tend to be wealthier, and it looks as if they choose it. Or education is a very important form of investment. I'm not sure what the payoff is, but people who choose not to go to school because I had enough of that, versus people who choose to go to school who suffer through it. The latter are investing and the former consuming. Good or bad, it's true also that tax subsidy policy alters behavior and affects outcomes. When our society taxes certain activities, it pushes people away from them. When it subsidizes certain activities, it pushes people in those directions. And let me just cite two what I think are examples of this. Everybody knows, of course, about tax loopholes because the rich are very attentive to those. And we know that when we create a tax loophole, rich people will find it. But when we create unemployment compensation, don't we encourage people to remain unemployed for longer periods of time? We surely do. The evidence is just overwhelming we do. To what extent? What kind of problem is that? Does that mean we should abolish unemployment compensation? No, I'm not saying that. It means we've got to think about it a little bit. To a large extent, the unemployment problem is a function of the system that we have for dealing with it. If you shift the responsibility, the liability for being unemployed, away from the shoulders of a person, that person will no longer feel as urgent a responsibility to hold a job. Welfare programs, I'm afraid, I would have to admit, do the same thing to some extent. Now, we're talking about the repudiation of common sense. I've arrived at the end. The common sense that it seems to me we are repudiating is this common sense that information is scarce. Nobody knows everything, therefore we have to make choices in an uncertain world, and we've got to economize on information. And the other part of it, it's related to it, is we have really, I wouldn't say we have altogether neglected the link between liability and responsibility. It seems to me, and I'm going to put it a little strongly, that we are rejecting it for one class of people and not rejecting it for another. I find a growing number of people in our society, especially intellectuals, saying poor people are not responsible for their actions. Rich people are. Now, they define poor people in a funny way. A poor person is anybody who patronizes a business, for example. All consumers are by definition poor. All elderly people are by definition poor. All people in business are by definition rich. But what we are doing is assuming in our tax laws and in our social policies generally that altering tax subsidy ratios, changing the rewards, i.e. shifting the liabilities, has an effect on the behavior of rich people and no effect on the behavior of poor people. I think that's wrong. I think it affects them both. And why? Why have we made that assumption? Why have we assumed that when you make it easier for a person, a poor person, to survive without holding a job, that poor person is less likely to hold a job? Or why is it that to assert that gets you stamped as a reactionary so quickly? Are we repudiating common sense, or is there some great truth that I have missed that has been grasped by those? So a friend once, well, acquaintance once said the trouble with you is you've got the viewpoint of an economist. An economist assumes that people make choices. Yeah, that's true. That's the basic economist way of looking at it, is assume people are making choices all the time. So what you need is more from sociology, because sociology explains why people don't have any choices to make. I think that's very insightful. Maybe there are these two perspectives. The economist perspective says people choose. The economist explains how people choose and the consequences of their choice. And then the sociologist comes along and talks about why people don't have any choices to make. In other words, but both these things are important. There are both constraints on choice, and I think there's the reality of choice. I have a little sense here that I've been drifting through trivia, so I want to point out how momentous it really is. My question again is, I've gone through all of these trivia because I want you to think about how we care for one another. And you see, some ways, obviously, of caring for one another don't work. Well, yeah, sure. I said there's nothing that is applicable there. Some ways don't work the way we think they work. Some things have unexpected consequences. And what I'm urging you to focus on is the link between liability, and responsibility. And I'll just say, I think it is almost impossible to focus there adequately if you try to deal with problems on the basis of 210 million at a time. I really believe strongly that we are going to have to begin caring for one another in smaller groups.
It certainly can be. Do you hear what she said? She says a kind of abdication of responsibility when you institutionalize care. Yes, I think the danger was always there, and I think the danger has become very much of a reality now. We're doing a lot of things in our society that are being heralded by some as humane acts and that I think are really abdications of responsibility. The one that I counter all the time is we're freeing people from mental institutions and putting them out in the community. Isn't that marvelous? i.e. we're abandoning them. That's what we're really doing. We say putting them in halfway houses. But those aren't halfway houses. They're none of the way houses. We're doing a lot of things.
Do you think the free enterprise system can care?
I don't think a system can care at all. The question, I think, would be to what extent does a free enterprise system make it possible or likely that people will care effectively? And I think it does a lot. I said at the beginning, and I'll repeat it now, I assume the free enterprise system or market system in all of this. I think that if we tried to care for one another after first destroying the free enterprise system, we would find that the problems had just grown enormously. But I think it's especially important that defenders of the free enterprise system, that business people and economists who tend to, for a variety of reasons, to see the virtues of the system, that they be the leaders in calling attention to the limitations of the system. And it's not enough to say government can't solve it either. If we've got to push further, I think we are discovering how that government can't solve them, and largely for the reasons that the market can't solve them, because the government tends to work a lot like the market. People respond to their interests, and you sort of have a free enterprise system running through government.
It is well known now that several of the Scandinavian countries are primarily welfare states in terms of social caring. Their systems are socialized in such a way that the basic needs are mm-hmm. taken care of throughout a person's life.
Yeah, and I think there's always something to be learned from these international comparisons and studies, but be aware of differences. You know, the Scandinavian countries are much smaller, much more homogeneous. The people are much less mobile. Mobility is a key factor. And there's all sorts of, I don't think we can just apply quickly to the United States lessons that are applicable, that are learned from
countries. And then they're having problems too.
They're having some problems too, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think there is a model in some countries, though, that maybe bears a hard look by many of the Christian denominations. Although I'm not a member of their denomination, it seems to me that what the Mormons are doing in terms of their group commitment to fellow Mormons and supporting the elderly, those poor, so to speak, mm-hmm. involves a substantial commitment personally, foremost, an individual tie to a group pool. They've essentially, it seems to me, duplicated a lot of the systems that have been set up on a national scale.
Yeah, I think the Mormons, that's a group from which much could be learned, worth studying. In my own area, I imagine this varies with part of the country, there's a good deal of hostility to the Mormons, for a variety of reasons, but some of it is related, I think, to the Mormon church doing exactly what you're talking about. Now, it's not that people object to the Mormons caring for one another. What they object to is the Mormons doing the things that they really have to do if they're going to care for one another effectively. And people see a lot of the activities of the Mormon church as a threat to a pluralistic society. I think that's unfortunate, somebody here had a question. Hand up.
Well, I was just thinking about if we did begin to care for each other in smaller groups and we became effective, do you think the government would back off?
Well,
there's a
chicken and egg problem there. You know, one of the reasons that we don't care for one another more effectively is that the government collects so much of our caring for money in taxes. And a lot of people say, well, we'd do it if the government would give us a rebate on our taxes. And there are some experiments just beginning with that sort of thing, where tax rebates are going to neighborhoods that are trying to provide services, where the municipality is saying, we won't provide the service you provide, we'll give you some tax rebates. It's just beginning, but it raises the host of problems. You know, what is the appropriate group to which to give the tax rebate? I guess I would really like to see, I hate it when people say, well, we're ready to start as soon as the federal government gives us a tax rebate. You know, in effect, backs out of the area. And then I don't think that's the way to begin. I believe that many of us have sufficient surplus resources that we can begin doing things that we think are worth doing. Let's do it first. Let's begin it. And let's say, hey, look, here's a good thing going. Now, wouldn't some of the rest of you like to try it? And what kinds of shifts in tax collection systems are necessary to help this? If we wait for the federal government to take the initiative, that's waiting for an elephant that moves very slowly.
About 3 times the last year.
Yeah.
We have a large number of private social agencies that are available and working in this area here. I'm wondering if their effectiveness is reducing.
You mean like United Way agencies? Yeah, you know, it's interesting, I think, how United Way agencies, at least in large cities, it's probably different in smaller towns, are becoming much more like and much more dependent upon the federal government. I sit on a United Way allocations committee in Seattle, and I was just shocked to discover the percentage of their income that came from the federal government, most of these agencies, in the field of addiction and health and mental health services. And the result, you can predict the result. People are becoming responsible to grantsmanship. And the big art being practiced by charitable agencies is grantsmanship, which is wheels within wheels. You know, what we're doing, we tax away the money and we put it up somewhere, then we hire enormous numbers of people to get that money back. Somewhere, you know.
Even in the small communities, 2 or 3 communities have band together to hire a person to help them. So we can get all the grants.
Hey, yeah, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, you talked about alcoholism and encouraging people to be irresponsible. Last night we had a discussion about homosexuality. Would you comment about that?
I think I'd rather not, because there are obviously complex issues of fact here in which I'm no kind of an authority. The point was broken.
An interesting parallel between those who would look at the alcoholic as an irresponsible person or as a person who is suffering under a health problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're talking about the church dealing with an incurable sin, in a sense. I mean, here I'm a kleptomaniac, or I'm a homosexual. If you say it is a sin, it's incurable. Or I'm an alcoholic. I mean, I just have a physiological need for the sin.
You know, that's a choice. When you say it's, you have a I think I don't use the term kleptomania because it says that people can't help it. And I like to assume people can help it. But I don't assume that people can help everything. There's a real question here. When can people choose? My own suspicion is that people who steal, quote, compulsively out of department stores can help it. And it's better to raise the question of why they're stealing. And at alcoholics, AA therapy assumes people can help it if given some help, and it seems to be the only therapy for alcoholism that has an established record of success. With homosexuality, I think the evidence on males is pretty clear that at least the overwhelming majority of male homosexuals do not choose that orientation. And I mean, the misery through which so many of them have gone, you know, trying to behave like heterosexuals, any more than, I, frankly, suppose I were told it was a sin to get excited by a woman, I'd be in trouble.
I'm saying by definition that kleptomania is something you can't choose. In other words, I'm saying all the things you can't choose, well then it's no use making the point. But if they can't choose, well then it would be analogous to some that could choose in another. It just happens to be sex, or it happens to be stealing, happens to be...
if people can't choose, if they cannot choose, then there's no sense in worrying about the problem of liability and responsibility if people don't choose. But I think we should be careful about deciding that people cannot choose.